This is Project 60. Good evening. This is Clyde McLean, inviting you to join us now for Project 60. A project devoted to developing better standards in creative radio. Project 60 is heard for 60 minutes each week at this time and is written and produced in the studios of WBT in Charlotte, North Carolina. This evening on Project 60, we bring you the Flying Saucers story. Some time ago, Project 60 regulars may recall the Edgar Cayce story, the story of the world-renowned psychic, written and researched for us by Joseph R. Myers of Charlotte. Mr. Myers examines this evening on Project 60 the story of flying saucers from outer space. It was a clear sunny day, the 24th of June, the year 1947. Veteran private pilot and businessman Kenneth Arnold had flown his small craft a few miles off course to see if he could spot the wreckage of a missing Army transport aircraft believed to have crashed near Tacoma, Washington. He was intently observing the mountain slopes when he became aware that he was not alone in the sky. His attention was drawn to and became instantly riveted upon nine shimmering, disc-like objects that were flashing in and out among the neighboring peaks at an estimated 1,000 miles an hour, and looking for all the world like they were playing a glorious game of follow the leader. Arnold's reputation for shrewdness as a pilot, coupled with his detailed description of the craft and his sincerity of manner, won the confidence of the skeptical news reporters, and his story was given full coverage. It flashed around the world with the newly coined descriptive term flying saucers included in the account. Seasoned airline pilots Childs and Whitted, early in June of 1948, on a flight near Montgomery, Alabama, encountered a large aerial craft three times the length of a B-29 bomber, which came alongside of them and circled their aircraft, apparently inspecting them. They said that it was torpedo-shaped and glowed all over with a dark blue light. There was a double row of ports or vents along the side, which emitted an unusual white light. After remaining a few minutes, the object suddenly loosed what appeared to be a sheet of flame 50 feet long, tilted up one end, and instantly accelerated to supersonic speed, leaving the slow-moving Douglas DC-3 aircraft rocking from the sudden movement of air caused by the instant departure of the gigantic craft. Tallying descriptions suggested that the same or a similar craft had been seen about 45 minutes earlier near Robbins Field at Macon, Georgia. With incidents such as these, dawned a new era, the era of the unidentified flying objects, the UFO. Are these craft real? Do they have people on them? What are they doing here? Such questions raced through the minds of thousands of people all over the earth. Our government soon organized a team of investigators within the Air Force to analyze and evaluate the UFO reports. More and more of them had begun to stream in from reliable sources. At first, the government team seemed determined to find all reports of the UFO to be merely natural phenomena or cases of mistaken identity. Reports turned in by men with excellent reputations and extensive flying experience were debunked by the government team with such unsatisfactory answers as, for example, implying that a veteran fighter pilot had engaged himself in a heated pursuit of the planet Venus, even exposing himself to possible court-martial by firing live ammunition at the planet in his confusion. Even the unfortunate case of Captain Mantell was treated as an example of confusion on the part of a veteran pilot that resulted in the destruction of his aircraft and the loss of his life. The Mantell incident occurred in the year 1948, on January 7th. All of the late papers in the U.S. that day carried headlines similar to those of the Louisville Courier. Quote, F-51 and Captain Mantell destroyed chasing flying saucer, unquote. It was at 1:15 on that afternoon when the control tower operators at Godman Air Force Base near Louisville began receiving calls about unusual aircraft in the area. They made a quick check with Wright-Patterson Air Base, which indicated that there were no flights about at that time. More reports came in through the State Highway Patrol. Persons from the surrounding towns gave several descriptions, which represented the object as circular, about 250 to 300 feet across. It was moving westward. At 1:45, the tower operators saw it. Word went around the base, and key personnel, including the base commander, Colonel Hicks, came to the tower to observe it. It was still in view at 2:30, and there was a discussion going on as to what should be done when a flight of four F-51 fighter craft neared the base. The tower operator gave the flight leader, Captain Mantell, the colonel's instructions to investigate the UFO. Mantell saw the object before his companions and pulled away from the rest of the flight. It was 2:45 when everyone on the tower heard Mantell say, "I see something above and ahead of me, and I'm still climbing." In the excitement, no one was sure that they remembered exactly how Mantell described what he saw. However, some agreed that he said, "It looks metallic, and it's tremendous in size." All did agree that the last words they heard were, "It's above me, and I'm gaining on it. I'm going to 20,000 feet." Mantell's plane apparently entered into some kind of force field, which caused it to break up in pieces from the indication of the wreckage. Parts of the ship were strewn over a wide area, and yet there was no sign that an explosion had occurred. The Air Force investigating team probably anticipated the flood of inquiries that would result from the publicity and felt they had to be ready with a quick answer. They had used the planet Venus to explain a well-publicized incident a few weeks earlier, and so almost before the rescue crews were dispatched to the crash, the word Venus went out again. This satisfied the newspaper editors, and so it stood, pending further research, that the veteran pilot Captain Mantell had been killed trying to overtake the planet Venus. But as time went on, the government began to issue statements that seemed to reflect a greater respect for the UFO reports. In an address before a group of reserve officers on June 1, 1953, Albert M. Chopp, public relations head for the Pentagon, with responsibility for the release of all publicity and statements regarding the UFO, said that out of the 3,000 or more cases that had been investigated up until that time, more than 25% had been ruled as authentic and unexplained UFOs. He said that our intelligence department was certain that no other nation was producing them, and that the Air Force emphatically denied that America had anything even remotely resembling them in the sky. The attitudes and convictions of the project members began to change as new evidence poured in. According to Edward Ruppelt, who headed up the government Project Blue Book, as it was then codenamed, the ever-increasing amount of data being accumulated, he said, had showed consistency in the phenomena themselves, and agreement in many of the details, although much of it was furnished by independent and widely separated observers. Some reports had even included motion picture film taken by trained cameramen. Navy photographer Delbert C. Newhouse, a warrant officer, furnished one of the notable examples of this kind of apparently tangible evidence of the UFO that are on file in the Pentagon. Newhouse was on leave from the Aviation Supply Depot in Oakland, California. He and his wife were driving along slowly near Tremonton, Utah, when they observed a formation of bright objects in the sky. They were round and brilliant, standing out clearly against the blue of the Utah sky. Newhouse immediately stopped the automobile, seized his 16-millimeter Bell & Howell motion picture camera, attached a telephoto lens, and shot 40 feet of film as the formation of brilliant objects maneuvered within camera range. At the last moment, one of the objects suddenly reversed its course and became separated from the others, while Newhouse followed it with his lens. After developing his film, Newhouse sent it with his report to Project Blue Book for evaluation. With customary thoroughness, the film was studied by experts of the Air Force Photo Reconnaissance Laboratory at Dayton, Ohio. According to Albert Chopp, the government spokesman at that time, the question of fraud was completely ruled out. Every trick method of duplicating the film had been tried unsuccessfully. Separate frames had been blown up to large scale to reveal any evidence of trickery. The film was pronounced genuine. The analysis of the film by project members was stated to indicate that the objects were traveling 1,000 miles an hour and performing what appeared to be intelligently controlled maneuvers that could not be achieved by any known aircraft, piloted or unpiloted. In his book about his experience as the boss of Project Blue Book, Edward Ruppelt indicates that some of the members of the government investigating team were becoming anxious to see official recognition given and a statement made that the UFOs were genuine and apparently not of earthly origin. Some of them, he said, felt that the general public should be given such information. Because of this situation, a conflict arose and a high-level decision became necessary. The story behind the decision is not altogether plain. It is possible that officials believed that the public was not yet ready to absorb such a momentous concept without becoming panicky. At any rate, government policy reverted again to across-the-board denial of the existence of genuine UFOs in the skies after the time of that decision. This policy seems still to be the order of the day, officially, where our own government is concerned. Whether or not the above is true, it is very possible that this move did much to ease a growing tension and fear that might otherwise have overcome the great mass of the people. Fantastic news about space visitors broken to the public without allowing enough time lapse for gradual conditioning of their minds might produce chaotic results. Although the government may have chosen to withhold its findings, there has been little indication of censorship of the work of private investigators into the saucer phenomena. A number of highly dedicated people who seem to feel that it is intensely important for the public to have what they believe to be the true story about the UFOs are continuing to gather data about the spaceships. They have published a number of excellent books giving their findings. Even Ruppelt, the former head of the government Project Blue Book, is among those who felt compelled to write a book to give the public an accurate account of the UFO data. In turning to the material available from private researchers, we found a wealth of documentation that has made our study into a richly rewarding adventure. Our search brought us into direct contact with a number of individuals who were deeply interested in the saucer phenomena. A dedicated private researcher in California by the name of Riley Crabb was recommended to us, and we placed the telephone call to him to get his views firsthand. Riley Crabb was interviewed by Joe Myers.
Mr. Crabb, you represent Borderland Sciences Research Associates as director.
Yeah.
We have been informed that you are exceptionally well qualified through your studies to talk about the flying saucers. Will you give us an indication of your background in the study of the UFO, the unidentified flying objects?
Well, my interest in the subject began in 1949 when I read Donald Kehoe's articles in True Magazine about flying saucers, and I thought that they appeared to be quite factual and weren't taken seriously. And then later on, I talked to military and civilian pilots there in Honolulu. I was living in Hawaii at the time, who had personal sightings of flying saucers, and this convinced me that the things were real.
Do you have any personal experiences?
No, I don't. And this puts me in a rather objective position, in a way, of evaluating the work of other people and not daring the public to call me a liar because I've seen one. But I've talked to, worked with qualified observers. And my work as director of Borderland Sciences Research Associates is to correlate material on sightings and analyze it for a possible value, you see. And I know, as far as I'm concerned, the things are real. There's no question about that.
Well, on what basis do you say the things are real? Will you give?
Well, because qualified people have seen them.
Would you give?
When a man has flown 10,000 hours in the air, a military pilot for years, and then he tells you that one night in one of his flights he saw something which raised the hair on the back of his head, a glowing object flying past his plane, and then has a ground radar station call him up and ask him to check on the location of an unidentified flying object in the sky, you've got an objective sighting, verified or backed up by mechanical or electronic equipment. And if you're flying in the plane at the time, and this man is the pilot, and your life is in his hands, you'd better believe him.
Well, now, this we surely agree to.
Will you give, call him a victim of hallucination?
Will you give us a specific example of a pilot with whom you have made conversation and a description of his sighting as he gave it to you?
I'd be glad to. A Navy pilot flying the Mars flying boats from San Francisco to Honolulu for years. And he told me one night, being on the bridge of the plane about halfway across, and dead ahead of the plane in the sky was what appeared to be a very bright planet. And it was glowing white, as most of the planets look in the sky, Venus or Jupiter or whatever. So he picked up a pair of binoculars to get a closer look at it, or a better look at it. He was surprised to see that it was going through all the colors of the rainbow. So this wasn't visible to a normal sight, at least without the glasses. And as he watched it, and thought this was really an unusual way for a planet to look, the thing suddenly moved sideways. And planets don't do that. And then he realized he was looking at an unidentified flying object, so he called the rest of the crew up onto the bridge. A total of seven people, all Navy personnel, and they all confirmed that they could see this object out there. And then about that time, he was called up by Weather Station Uncle. This is the Weather Bureau ship that's on station out there in the Pacific to give weather information and the directions to ships and planes. And they said they had a UFO on their radar screen at maximum distance, about 70 or 80 miles, and vectored him to the location of this UFO and corresponded to the glowing object they were looking at. And then the lieutenant told me that about that time, the thing just grew smaller and smaller and disappeared. Now, this lieutenant was so interested in flying saucers that he invited me to give an illustrated lecture on them to the Kokua Club, the informal group that met once a week there at the lunchroom, the restaurant at the International Airport of Honolulu. This is a group of commercial pilots and Air Force personnel and military and civilian flying people to try to give them some idea of what this subject is consists of.
During that lecture, did any of the other pilots confirm that they had also seen such...
Yes, they did. In fact, of course, I sat at the speaker's table, and there were three other people there at the table with me. A civilian officer of Hawaiian Airlines, and a Navy captain, and this lieutenant, who was the pilot of the Mars flying boat. And they, in turn, told their flying saucer sightings, and I was the only one at the table who hadn't actually seen one or didn't claim to have seen one, yet I was the lecturer.
Are you familiar with pictures that you consider authentic?
Oh, yes. Yes, we have, I might say, literally hundreds of flying saucer pictures in our files. It's a very interesting matter to compare them, of course. Some may be fake, but others appear to be genuine.
Would you give us an example of the circumstances of a photograph that you consider authentic?
Well, one that I would consider authentic because it's on file with the government in Washington somewhere, because it was taken by a member of the Ground Observation Corps. The gentleman was on duty as a Ground Observation Corps member, and one night in July 1952 in Jersey City, looking toward New York City. And he saw a glowing object in the sky in the direction of New York City, and he got an excellent picture of it that night. And this picture is on file, was turned in as a part of his official report of having seen an unidentified flying object in the sky. So this is one example of government duplicity, we might say, when official agencies issue a report saying that they have no physical evidence that flying saucers exist. We do know that they have some pictures.
Well, I'm sure that they mean rather that there's no evidence that they consider incontestable, not that they have no evidence.
Yes. Are they going to believe their own observers? Who are they to believe?
What about the question of communication between the flying saucer personnel and Earth?
Well, we have examples, some which would appear to be authentic in our files, and I have talked to people who have had communications. Now, this, of course, gets into the area of the fourth dimension and extrasensory perception or telepathy in many cases. And then you move out of the field of so-called orthodox scientific inquiry into the area of human fallibility or the receptivity of the human mind, and this is where orthodox science doesn't want to go.
Do you have personal contacts with individuals who believe they have contacted flying saucer individuals?
Yes, I've had, perhaps three or four contacts with such individuals over the years. Individuals who appeared to be reliable as far as character went.
Would you describe the circumstances or any of the background that would...
Well, one of the best, undoubtedly, is that of Dan Fry, who was a technician with Aerojet back in 1950 out there at White Sands Proving Ground, and... Apparently, he was offered a ride in a spaceship on the night of July 4th, 1950, and accepted. Now, at that time, he thought he was in his physical body, and as far as he was concerned, it was a physical experience. And yet he has been talking to occult scientists and students of metaphysics since then. He has had to admit the possibility that his body might actually have been asleep, so to speak, or in trance. In his quarters there at White Sands, and that the experience was really not physical at all. And this, of course, is what makes the whole thing so difficult to understand. We don't deny it. This also is a good reason why the authorities are so reluctant to come out with any authoritative explanation of flying saucers.
I see. What about the question of crashed flying saucers? There seems to be rumors that there have been crashed saucers.
Yes, we have several eyewitness accounts of crashed spaceships, saucers in New Mexico and Arizona in 1949. And then we have one which was crashed on the island of Spitsbergen in the North Arctic region in July of 1952. That was seen coming down by Norwegian jet planes and followed down. Then there was an inquiry by the Norwegian government, and after 3 years, in 1955, they finally released their report of the analysis of this crashed spaceship. And the conclusion was that it had been made by processes unknown to any government here on Earth, and apparently was not manufactured here on Earth. The materials were not known to present technology science.
In other words, they found the actual remains and brought them into the government premises to examine them.
Yes, the report was released to the public through the newspapers in 1955. I have a translation of the news clipping here. Colonel Gernot Darnbeil of the Norwegian Air Force Board of Inquiry made the statement after 3 years of looking at the thing. I don't know why more people don't know this than the newspapers. Maybe they forget these things because they don't want to remember them.
Well, perhaps that's true. You've given us a lot of background material here, and I believe you say you've been studying them since 1947?
1949 was when my interest started in this subject.
I see. This is a long time to put in on the study of flying saucers.
Yes. Of course, we're in the area now, you see, of these philosophical problems involved. Having accepted the reality of the things, we've gone on to the area of why they are here and who they might be. And what would be the impact of on our society of a general realization and acceptance of the idea that outer space is inhabited and that there may be races superior to us in evolution elsewhere in the universe.
I see. And that is
a real problem, you see.
From your own standpoint, then, your own quest has satisfied you that they are real, they do exist.
Yes.
I see.
We're not alone.
Joe Myers, talking with Riley Crabb in California. Some of these private researchers have not only spent years in their study of the phenomena, but had also traveled thousands upon thousands of miles to verify the information that they had. Bryant and Helen Reeve were among these latter people. Bryant Reeve, an MIT graduate and chief engineer of the Nash Galvanator manufacturing plant in Detroit before his retirement around 1954, identified himself as being thoroughly skeptical toward flying saucers when he first heard of them. He felt that anyone trained in the field of engineering would be inclined to be incredulous. Not only did Bryant and Helen Reeve become believers in the reality of the spaceships, but they eventually wrote a very intriguing book on the subject entitled Flying Saucer Pilgrimage. We visited with the Reeves at their summer home at Virginia Beach, Virginia, to hear their views in person regarding some aspects of their search. We shall let Bryant Reeves speak for himself through the tape recording of our conversation, which took place in October of 1963. Mr. Reeve, how does a practical-minded man like yourself become interested in flying saucers?
Well, I was extremely skeptical. This goes back quite a long way, almost 10 years, when we lived in Detroit, Michigan, and I was engaged in manufacturing work. But some friends of ours brought in a book on flying saucers, and this first I'd ever heard of them. I thought it was just science fiction, but my wife, Helen, seemed quite interested. And this finally resulted in an amazing event in which we brought the author of the book all the way from California to Detroit to question him in regard to his experience. This book was called Flying Saucers Have Landed by George Adamski and Desmond Leslie of England.
Had it occurred to you that you and your wife might write a book on the subject later?
No, that was farthest from our mind, but shall we put it this way? When people retire, some of them make a hobby of golf, and some of them fishing, and some of them collecting curios of various kind. Well, we sort of made a hobby of trying to find out whether it was true that we were in an age when spaceships from outer space were actually visiting the Earth. We actually spent over 2 years of travel, and we traveled 23,000 miles on this quest. And after we had visited many people who had had sightings or claimed they had had sightings, and some had had contacts with these visitors from outer space, we moved over into Old Mexico and spent 6 months there investigating the subject. And this proved very fruitful.
Was there a particular incident that won you and Mrs. Reeve over to this belief that you now express in regard to the UFO?
Well, I think I started out as a, shall I say, about the rankest skeptic in the whole field. But there was no particular event. First, we started investigating sightings, and we talked to hundreds of people who had had these experiences. And we found that they weren't uncommon. Also, we began to, through correspondence, we began to get in touch with a picture on a worldwide basis, and this was quite amazing. These same kind of adventures were happening all over the world, not only in the United States. I don't think it was any particular outstanding event, but just a fantastic accumulation of evidence, which finally led both of us to the acceptance that this is true, that spaceships are visiting the Earth and at this in this era.
Did your research convince you that generally fraud could be discounted?
I don't think fraud or even the wildest of imagination could account for the consistency of these phenomena on a worldwide basis. Because people who had never heard of each other in different countries were having similar experiences. I think our approach was somewhat along the line that is used and understood in our democratic society in regard to law. People are called to jury service. And then before the jury is presented certain facts. And then they pass judgment on these facts. Well, I think that we approach the whole subject pretty much in this manner, trying to keep objective, trying to keep sensible. But if we were on a jury and all of this evidence that we uncovered was presented to us, I think we as a jury would say yes, it must be so.
Apparently then, Mr. Reeve, you no longer have any reservations about the reality of the UFO.
No, we have none, and also, please understand that our views are not merely those of two individuals. We have followed the research of many other private individuals in many parts of the world, and our views coincide pretty much with a sort of the average view of many of these researchers.
Tell us then, Mr. Reeve, why do you think they are here?
Why are they here? Of course, this is one of the greatest questions, shall we say, the $60 million question in regard to this phenomenon. But I think that the consensus of opinion among the serious and intelligent private researchers is that this tremendous advent of spaceships in the atmosphere of Earth is indicative of a great new age into which the Earth seems to be moving. These are not hostile craft. The air forces of many of the great powers, after years of investigation, have come to this conclusion that we are not facing an invasion from outer space. We are facing a friendly interest in our planet. And the opinion of the researchers, drawing on all types and kinds of evidence which they could uncover, tends to show that we are entering a great changed era on the Earth, and that these people with a greater cosmic perspective are somewhat in the capacity of our elder brothers who are taking an interest in us. They've been through this type of experience many, many thousands of years ago, and they have come to try to help us adjust ourselves to the changes of this age.
Do you and your wife, Helen, feel that we might regard these space people as guardians to the planet Earth?
Yes, some of the researchers have used that very term because it seems that there is government in outer space, just as there is government in many, many phases of the Earth, and that there's a government of planets and solar systems and even galaxies. And if we wish to call these beings, these intelligences, guardians, it seems that that's a very appropriate term. Incidentally, these guardians seem to regard planets somewhat like schoolrooms, and we're the school children on the planet Earth. And so, in a way, they're the schoolmasters, and they're interested in seeing that the school children don't burn down the schoolhouse, so to speak.
Would this be the reason why there have been frequent sightings in the vicinity of atomic plants?
Yes, I think this is part of it. And one researcher or several have plotted sightings and saucer phenomena relative to the geographical fault lines of the Earth. And this produced some very astounding data. And look it over, it would seem that these ships have made almost a scientific survey of the fault lines of the Earth. We are experiencing a few earthquakes these days, and maybe they're studying this condition on the Earth somewhat.
What are your thoughts on the ideas of our communicating with these unidentified flying objects?
This subject of communication is one of the definite chapters in a serious, comprehensive research into this subject. It's a very fascinating one. Apparently, there has been communication between people on the Earth and these beings. This may seem absolutely preposterous to those who have not studied the matter, and it did to us to start with. But the proof, partly, of this is that some of the great saucer phenomena or experiences of people on the Earth have been set up by some type of, shall we say, ESP communication in advance. In other words, some type of an ESP message was received. You'll be at a certain place at a certain time, and there you'll have a saucer experience. And this has worked out on many occasions. So it seems that there is communication. We feel that it's been carried on through many, many means. In a few cases, through electronic means. The language of outer space, it seems more and more, must be the language of thought. And so this sort of gets into a study of the ESP phases of communication, a very deep and a very interesting subject.
You say there has been communication. What is the general pattern of this communication?
Well, we've studied this type of communication for 9 years. It comes in from many, many sources. It's quite voluminous. It takes a lot of patience to study it and coordinate it. By the way, it might interest you that we've given a name to this type of communication. We call it OSC, for Outer Space Communication. This means communication between Earthmen and the space beings by any means, not only extrasensory perception means, but any other means. And we've made a very profound study along with other researchers, and in general, I think it's impressive that the messages convey a great sense of goodwill between these higher beings and ourselves. I think this is the main impression of it. It's a little distressing to people who've made this kind of study to have somebody get up, as sometimes occurs, and try to say that these people are enemies from outer space. The whole tone of all of this type of communication is one of goodwill and helpfulness toward the Earth. Sometimes these researchers, like ourselves, feel that if the people of the Earth had been more receptive to this phenomena and this approach from outer space, we might have had much more personal contacts than has happened on the Earth. But remember, the general receptivity of this civilization has been very poor, except for private individuals. The great governments of the world have gone into a blanket of secrecy in regard to this, and so it's almost been up to individuals to try to find out these facts, and in case someone is interested, they're willing to share them.
Mr. Bryant Reeve, a private researcher into the subject of unidentified flying objects, an MIT graduate, a chief engineer of the Nash Calvinator manufacturing plant in Detroit before he retired in 1954. It is interesting to find that men of high reputation in the scientific world have voiced their belief in the celestial visitor explanation of the flying saucers. As an example of this, we have selected a quotation from one of the greatest of our space-age scientific minds, Hermann Oberth. Often called the grand old man of rocketry, Professor Oberth is the towering imaginative genius who pioneered in the formulation of the original design concepts for rocket propulsion some 35 years ago. After World War II, he joined with his former pupil, von Braun, to assist in America's space program. Professor Oberth unequivocally expressed his views upon the UFO in an article published in the American Weekly, dated October 24, 1954. From his article entitled Flying Saucers Come from a Distant World, we quote the following.
I think that they are possibly manned by intelligent observers who are members of a race that may have been investigating our Earth for centuries. I think that they possibly have been sent to conduct systematic long-range investigations, first of men, animals, and vegetation, and more recently of atomic centers, armaments, and centers of armament production. I have examined all of the arguments supporting the existence of flying saucers and denying it, and it is my conclusion that the unidentified flying objects do exist, are very real, and are visitors from outer space.
Military leaders have expressed opinions similar to those of scientist Oberth. The wartime boss of the British Royal Air Force Fighter Command, Air Chief Marshal Lord Dowling, said that he believed that there are flying saucers from other planets in our atmosphere, although he stated that he had not seen any personally. Having access to information equal to, or even superior to that which our own military executives have, apparently Lord Dowling believed that these views of his should be made public. The New York Post, dated October 4th, 1955, published an account of a lecture he had just given in which he stated that the evidence for their existence is overwhelming. He also said that he did not expect them to land and give us any of their scientific knowledge until we had learned some better manners. There are numerous stories that indicate that actual tangible evidence, such as wreckage from crashed saucers, is in the possession of various governments around the world. Access to this knowledge by certain reputable people in government may provide the basis for the rather strong affirmations upon the reality of saucers that these highly placed officials have made. In an International News Service report from London in May of 1955, Miss Dorothy Kilgallen sent in a story that was given wide publicity. The following is quoted from her story as it appeared in the Miami Herald on May 23, 1955.
I can report on a story which is positively spooky. British scientists and airmen, after examining the wreckage of a mysterious flying ship, are convinced that these strange aerial objects are not optical illusions or Soviet inventions, but originate on another planet. The source of my information is a British official of cabinet rank who prefers to remain unidentified. We believe, on the basis of our inquiries thus far, that the saucers are staffed by small men, probably under 4 feet tall, my informant told me. It's frightening, but there is no denying that the flying saucers come from another planet. This official quoted scientists as saying that a flying ship of this type could not possibly have been constructed on Earth. The British government, I learned, is withholding an official report on the flying saucer examination at this time, possibly because it does not wish to frighten the public.
Many investigators seem to believe that for almost 200 years now, we have been subjected to an increasingly intensified program of observation by the space people, if the number of sightings by competent individuals is any indication. Many records of these sightings from earlier times are from ships' logs and were observations by sea captains. Others come from astronomers who seem to have been sighting objects passing across the face of the moon as long as we have had telescopes. Here are some examples of sightings in the past 90 years that sound remarkably similar to our present-day accounts. On September 26, 1870, the London Times reported a strange elliptical object that was seen to cross the face of the moon. A year later, on August 1, 1871, citizens of Marseille, France, sighted a large round object moving slowly across the sky, apparently at a very high altitude. At Cattenau, Germany, on March 22, 1880, several bright, luminous objects were sighted just before dawn, moving westward as they climbed. This account was published in the British Nature magazine. In 1885, the Bermuda Royal Gazette described a mysterious round object that had flown over the islands. And later that same year, on November 1st, an astronomer and others reported sighting a huge round object over Adrianople, Turkey. In 1888, an oval-shaped disk was reported seen over New Zealand, speeding along at a high altitude. In 1890, aerial objects were sighted over the Dutch East Indies. And about the same time, objects were seen in the sky over England and Scotland, one of which was described by a British admiral as a large disk with a projection that looked like a tail. A notable sighting occurred in America in 1878. And the story appeared in the Denison, Texas Daily News, dated January 25th, which mentioned an observer's comparison of the object with a huge, quote, flying saucer, unquote. Of these sightings from the past, perhaps the most astounding and thoroughly documented is an account of an unidentified flying object over America, which occurred in 1897. A huge, cigar-shaped aerial ship that displayed red, green, and white lights made a leisurely tour through the skies over many of the Middle Western and Far Western states, being seen by thousands of people and reported at length by many major newspapers. An official publication of the United States Weather Bureau, the magazine Weather Review, gave an account in a 1907 issue. It described an incident in which a torpedo-shaped aerial machine was seen as it circled over Burlington, Vermont, and was observed to drop a glowing object which exploded before it struck the ground. The noted author and tireless investigator of the UFO, Donald E. Kehoe, is particularly in sympathy with the belief that the celestial ships have been visiting the Earth down through the ages, and that they come from other planets. His books offer documentary evidence that there have been occasional scatterings of the space visitors in our skies since time immemorial. Although the official position of our government has lent little encouragement to these views, there is yet a clear indication of its respect for those who have propounded them. Before publishing the script of Major Donald E. Kehoe's book titled Flying Saucers from Outer Space, which firmly implies the space visitor origin of the celestial objects, his publisher asked the Air Force for an official release. The publisher was given the release and also an endorsement of Major Kehoe's work, which reads in part as follows, quote, "His long association and cooperation with the Air Force in our study of unidentified flying objects qualifies him as a leading authority on this investigation. The Air Force and its investigative agency, Project Blue Book, are aware of Major Kehoe's conclusion that the flying saucers are from another planet. The Air Force has never denied that this possibility exists. Some of the personnel believe that there may be some strange natural phenomena completely unknown to us. But if the apparently controlled maneuvers reported by many competent observers are correct, then the only remaining explanation is the interplanetary answer," unquote. Most of the incidents that have been cited are taken from records that were accumulated prior to the year 1955. This is simply because there was much more publicity given to the sightings in the earlier years. A natural question which will occur to the inquisitive mind is what is happening today in the flying saucer investigation? Perhaps an answer to this may be found in an article which appeared in the Yale Scientific Magazine, dated April 1963. The top Air Force UFO consultant, also a noted astrophysicist, Dr. J. Allen Hynek, wrote the article from which we quote as follows.
Flying saucers have by no means died out, as was once confidently expected. There are more UFO reports per year rather than less. Further, for every puzzling report that reaches Air Force attention, there are many more that do not.
In his article, the Air Force chief UFO scientist commented that oftentimes many witnesses may submit almost identical reports. He said that the level of intelligence of the observers was usually average or above, and that in some cases it was embarrassingly above average. He also noted that the phenomena are not in the least bit limited to the United States, but are definitely worldwide. More sightings per square mile, he stated, occurred in England than in the United States. But he also said there were many reported sightings from France, Brazil, Spain, Italy, Australia, Canada, and even several Iron Curtain countries. A religious leader in England seemed to have anticipated the times that we are now entering. The late Bishop Barnes of Birmingham, England, at the Congress of the British Association for the Advancement of Science at Westminster, London, on September 29th in the year 1931, expressed these views.
There are many other inhabited worlds, and on some of them, beings exist who are immeasurably beyond our mental level. we should be rash to deny that they can use radiation so penetrating as to convey messages to Earth. Probably such messages come now. When they are first made intelligible, a new era in the history of humanity dawns. At the beginning of the new era, the opposition between those who welcome the new knowledge and those who deem it dangerously subversive may lead to a world war. But I should like to be living then, when we begin this new era. We might get a true understanding of the beginning of the universe.
Appropriate closing words for our story may lie in a quotation from a Bavarian Catholic theologian, the Reverend Philip Dessauer, who spoke upon the subject of celestial visitations in Munich on July 29, 1954.
The evidence seems to demonstrate with adequate certainty that intelligent beings from another planet have been observing the Earth for the last 8 years. If it is possible to make contact with these beings, it will be the most dramatic event in history. It is the duty of governments to prepare man for the possibility of such an encounter.
And there you have the Flying Saucer story, researched and written for Project 60 by Joseph R. Myers of Charlotte. Are there really unidentified flying objects? Are they really from outer space? What is their purpose? At this time, any true answer could only be conjecture. But you must admit, interesting conjecture. You have been listening to Project 60, a project devoted to developing better standards in creative radio. Project 60 is produced in the studios of WBT Radio in Charlotte, North Carolina. This is Clyde McLean, inviting you to join us next week at the same time when once again this station presents Project 60. Until then, good evening.